So Hare Krishna, welcome to the start of a series of classes as we head towards Janmashtami. Ribo, Sri Janmashtami Mahamotsav ki jai. So today I've been asked to speak on Dasya Ras a little bit, and with a focus on Akrura. So the verse today is about Akrura's meditation as he comes to see Krishna. So it's a nice way for us to start our focus on Janmashtami, which is just around the corner, next week. On which day? Wednesday. So not long at all now. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and then Wednesday is Janmashtami. So we'll discuss something about Dasya Ras, and hopefully it will put us in a good mood as we prepare to celebrate a festival in a slightly different manner to normal. I think we're all a little bit phased at the moment, because for the last month or so we should have been running around on the fields doing all sorts of things. But this is an unusual situation, so we're here in a more meditative mood. And so this is an ideal chance to have a very meditative Janmashtami. And today's today's discussion on Akrura will hopefully give us some hints as to how to meditate. So this is the verse 10:38-27, and I'll just read a couple of verses before that. So we'll start a little earlier, around text 23. Now Akrura has made a plan on the request or order of Kamsa to go to see Krishna. And so he's imagining what is going to happen when he meets Krishna. So he describes how in text 22, the Supreme Lord has no favorite and no dearmost friend, nor does he consider anyone undesirable, despicable, or fit to be neglected. All the same, he lovingly reciprocates with his devotees in whatever manner they worship him, just as the trees of heaven fulfill the desires of whoever approaches them. The Lord says something similar in the Bhagavad Gita: I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. But whoever renders service to me in devotion is a friend and is in me, and I am also a friend to him. So it continues, and then Lord Krishna's elder brother, the foremost of the Yadus, will grasp my joined hands while I am still standing with my head bowed, and after embracing me, he will take me to his house. There he will honor me with all items of ritual welcome, and inquire from me about how Kamsa has been treating his family members. So this is Akrura speaking, of course. He's imagining the reception he will get. Shukadev Goswami continued, my dear king, while the son of Shvapalka, traveling on the road, thus meditated deeply on Sri Krishna, he reached Gokul as the sun was beginning to set. In the cowherd pasture, Akrura saw the footprints of those feet whose pure dust the rulers of all the planets in the universe hold on their crowns. Those footprints of the Lord, distinguished by such marks as the lotus, barleycorn and elephant goad, made the ground wonderfully beautiful. Increasingly agitated by ecstasy at seeing the Lord's footprints, his bodily hair standing on end because of his pure love, and his eyes filled with tears, Akrura jumped down from his chariot and began rolling about among those footprints, exclaiming, ah, this is the dust from my master's feet. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda ki. This is the approach into Gokul for Akrura. And now we come to today's verse. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. The very goal of life for all embodied beings is this ecstasy, which Akrura experienced when, upon receiving Kamsa's order, he put aside all pride, fear and lamentation, and absorbed himself in seeing, hearing and describing the things that reminded him of Lord Krishna. Purport: Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that Akrura gave up fear by openly showing his love and reverence for Krishna, even though he or his family might have been punished by the angry Kamsa. Akrura gave up his pride in being an aristocratic member of society and worshipped the cowherd residents of the simple village of Vrindavan. And he gave up lamenting for his house, wife and family, which were in danger from King Kamsa. Giving up all these things, he rolled in the dust of the lotus feet of God. Srila Prabhupada ki. And that is exactly Akrura's mood. A complete focus on Krishna, a great love for Krishna, and in one sense, deliberate neglect of the hopeless situation he was in under Kamsa. He had an important role in Kamsa's kingdom. He was a top person. He was considered like a king, a subordinate king almost, with that equivalent level of prominence. And somehow he was in this position where he was serving a tyrant. But his attention, his focus was always Krishna. His heart was always Krishna. So Kamsa at one point gives Akrura an order. And his order is to go and bring Krishna. Now, to put it in context, prior to that, Kamsa has enacted a few executive decisions. Kamsa's policy in the early stages, in the early days, you can say, of Krishna's birth, Kamsa wasn't really aware directly that Krishna had taken birth. And he was kind of aware that it's possible that he has taken birth because he had the Akashvani saying, "You fool, the child has already been born." But he didn't know where he was or who he was. So he had this campaign of unleashing unfocused terror. That was his campaign. To terrorize the villages. He tried to kill so many children in the hope that he would kill Krishna. He would send his army, his demons, out to different places to try and uncover where Krishna was. And so these pastimes were going on while Krishna was younger. But all this time, Kamsa didn't really know where Krishna was, or where the source of his death was. So at one point, Krishna kills this bull demon, Arishtasura. You know the story how he appears near Krishna's village and all the villagers terrified. But then Krishna very easily picks him up by the horns and throws him a good distance. So imagine throwing a bull. If you just want to get an idea of the scale of that task, just go and say hello to one of our bulls. Can you imagine lifting one of them up and throwing them a distance? No, typically we end up flying if you try that. But Krishna did this, but this bull was still quite strong, and he didn't want to give up without a fight. So he had another go, and he rushed towards Krishna. So Krishna once again did the same thing. He grabbed him by the horns, but on this occasion it's described, he picked him up by the horns and just whacked him on the ground as one cleans dirty washing. That's it. That was the glamorous end of Arishtasura. That's how easily Krishna dispensed with him, a mighty demon. Just thrown about like bits of rag. Well, after this, of course, that led to a whole wonderful pastime taking place. Because we know from that point that the gopis refused to have any connection with Krishna. Because they said, "You've been contaminated. You've killed, after all, a bull." Okay, fair enough, he was a demon, but that's a small point. The fact is, you've killed a bull, and the bull represents religion. He said, anyway, that's a different story. But essentially, Radhakund appears after that point, when Krishna has to be purified. He creates Krishnakund and then Radhakund appears. So These are some of Krishna's pastimes that happened during the anonymous phase, where Kamsa isn't really aware of his qualities. But what typically happens to help demons move to the next phase of their persecution? What do you think normally happens? It's a little unconventional. They get a message. Actually, Kamsa's had a message before already. It was actually the Akashvani that almost motivated him to kill his sister on the day of her marriage. And of course, he wanted to kill Vasudev many times, but then all the children. On this occasion, though, it's a messenger, but it's a special messenger, Narad Muni. And Narad Muni, as we know, often turns up when there's a need to encourage the demons to meet their end more quickly than normal. So if he feels that this demon's activities, prowess in this world could go on for a little longer than required, then he arranges somewhat unconventionally to deal with the situation. So Narad Muni informs Kamsa of the actual facts. He says, actually, Kamsa, you know, there are these two boys, and you're constantly afraid and constantly wondering who is killing all your soldiers and your demons. Well, it's these two boys, Krishna and Balaram, in this place, in Gokul. And Kamsa says, I must deal with this immediately. So Narad Muni has effectively instigated him into now embarking on the next phase of his terror campaign. So he wants to kill Vasudev immediately upon hearing this, and so many other people. But Narad Muni says, don't be so rash. It's these two boys who are the source of your danger, not anyone else. So just be aware of that. And after offering that good advice, Narad Muni leaves. Interesting advice, no? you tell the tyrant exactly where the lambs are kept. And that's actually an analogy used to describe Kamsa. He's like a tiger taking care of lambs and sheep. Would you feel safe in that situation? No. So there he's given this advice, and so Kamsa then makes a few decisions. He gets some ministers. He first of all sends two demons along, Keshi and then Vyomasur. And of course Krishna deals with them. But while that's going on, he dispatches them, and then he calls in his messengers, his trusted servants, his trusted leaders, his trusted management team, Kamsa's management team. Remember that, or imagine that. What a team! So he first of all finds Chanura and Mushtika, who are wrestlers, very strong, powerful wrestlers, and he says to them, just be ready. I'm soon going to conduct a big sacrifice here, a bow sacrifice. And you can prepare a grand arena for a grand wrestling match to take place. And make sure there are many viewing areas, many areas where people from the villages can all come and watch this spectacle. And I'm going to bring Krishna here, and when he comes, I want you two to finish him off. Chanura and Mushtika have received this order and they're getting ready to prepare. So they get the bundle ready, they get the dais ready, they get all the different areas prepared. Then he calls the owner of this elephant called Kuvalyapida. And Kuvalyapida is a magnificent, monstrous creature. He is enormous. And he says to his elephant handler, he says, this elephant of yours is very powerful, and I have a special task for you. Soon Krishna is going to come here, but I want you to station yourself just outside the wrestling arena. And when Krishna comes to try to enter, I want you to kill him. Have your elephant kill him. No one can withstand the power of your elephant. So that's second order. And Kuvalyapida goes off to get the elephant ready. Prepares him, dresses him nicely, and gets him ready. And then the final executive order from Kamsa is to Akrura, who he welcomes. Just like a friend, he says, "My dear Akrura, there is no one more trusted than you. Now just look, here is a magnificent chariot, a brand new chariot." And Kamsa's intention, he has just offered Akrura a brand new chariot. His hope was that Akrura would think, "Wow, a nice new Sankirtan vehicle. I must go out." He said, "It would be great fun to drive this chariot." That's what Kamsa is thinking. And he says to Akrura, "Akrura, I have a special task for you. I want you to go to this village of Vrindavan, and I want you to bring back these two boys, Krishna and Balaram. Bring them back here on this chariot. And when they come back," Kamsa was actually quite straightforward. He said, I'm going to bring them here, and I'm going to kill them. And after I've killed them, I'm then going to kill his father. I'm going to kill Nanda Maharaj. I'm going to kill Vasudev. Then I'm going to kill all their relatives. I'm going to kill all the other kings who are inimical to me. And then I'm actually going to even kill Ugrasena, who is my father. Because of course, Ugrasena was entitled to be the ruler. But Kamsa had taken away that position. And so he was thinking, "I will kill Ugrasena." So he had a whole plan, and nothing very respectable about this plan. But he disclosed it all to Akrura, and he said, "After that, when everyone who causes me trouble has been vanquished, I will rule the earth peacefully." That's Kamsa's plan. Divide, conquer, destroy, and I will rule the earth peacefully. That's actually the... You will notice there's a pattern here. With all the other tyrants, Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, Hiranyaksha, that is their plan. Remove all threats to my position, all threats to my kingdom, all of those people who cause me difficulties, so I will be able to rule peacefully with you, my dear supporters, as my soldiers. That's the Kami world. That's the dog-eat-dog world. And that's Kamsa's world. So it's a blueprint given by Kamsa for how people who are on the demoniac side want to conduct themselves. Now Akrura heard all this and he thought, "Very good, very good, very nice instruction." He thought, "There is absolutely no point me saying anything to this person." He's thinking, "I want to take this chariot to go to see Krishna and to bring him back." But the actual fact is, as our acharyas explain, that a used chariot is not really fit for Krishna. So it is very nice that you have supplied this wonderful, new, beautiful, clean chariot, which is fitting to bring Krishna back. Also, what a wonderful service that I get to go and meet Krishna. And it's doubly wonderful, because although Kamsa, you are a fool, and you do not realize the consequences of the decision that you have just made, still it is an excellent decision, because it means that your end is that much sooner. This was Akrura's meditation. So he said something very subtle and covered to Kamsa. Kamsa didn't quite understand it in the same way. He thought he was speaking some high philosophy. But effectively, this is what Akrura said to him. He said, "Yes, we make our decisions, and we do not know the consequences of those decisions. We're attached to a certain outcome, and we try to fulfill that outcome even if everything is against us, even if fate is against us." So what is the chance of fulfilling an outcome when fate is against that outcome? None. The only person who can do that and get away with it is Krishna, because fate serves a subservient role to Krishna. But for no one else is that a viable project. It is always best to have Krishna on our side, the plan of the Lord on our side, before we try to enact our plans. So Akrura is thinking like this, and this is the start of his meditation. From that moment, he starts thinking. And that's the place we're at today, in today's verse. That he has now left, he has left Mathura, after spending the night there. He left the next day, after this instruction from Kamsa. And he traveled along the road, and he was just imagining Krishna. He was imagining Balaram. He was imagining the cowherd folk, the pastimes that they get up to there. He was imagining, as we're seeing now, what will happen when I finally see Krishna, when I finally see Balaram. What will happen? He says, as in today's verse, he absorbed himself in seeing, hearing and describing the things that reminded him of Lord Krishna. That is a symptom, that is a trait of all sincere devotees of the Lord. Akrura here is in a stage of separation. He's been in separation for some time. But now he has a chance for union, to meet Krishna. And in that space in between, there is that wholesome meditation. That meditation of putting aside all our worries, putting aside, as it's mentioned here, pride, fear, and lamentation. These are things that often arise and actually impede our devotional service. Imagine we are in a difficult situation, as Akrura was, under a tyrant, in a difficult environment. Normally that causes us disturbance. And who wouldn't be disturbed? It's normal. Certainly, all of those people around Kamsa were highly disturbed. Even the cowherd folk were disturbed at various points by Kamsa's persecution. It's not really a sign of weakness that someone is disturbed by a tyrant. That's normal. The history of tyrants isn't that they are nice and friendly. They actually cause a lot of damage. They cause a lot of trouble. In Lord Ram's Leela, the various demons sent by Ravana would terrorize the brahmanas. They would kill them. They would eat them. They would destroy sacrifices. They would cause a lot of trouble. They weren't sort of textbook demons, just demons from nice, harmless demons that Krishna kills or Lord Ram kills. These are persons who actually enact terror. And so it's a dangerous situation. And so many times such persons were disturbed in the practice of their service. Because what can you do? When you attempt to start a sacrifice and a demon comes and throws bucket loads of stool and pus and urine and blood and sends down rakshasas to kill, which was what was happening during that time. What can you do? Your entire effort is gone. But still, the point is that we should not give up. We should not give up our motivation. We should not give up our determination to carry on despite the challenges of this world. In Prabhupada's preaching, there were so many challenges. Many encouraging things happened. Prabhupada was always encouraged when another person was extracted from the lap of the witch Maya and brought into the realm of Krishna. Yet another person. He was so happy. And he considered all these people to have been sent by his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Those were the encouraging items. But then there were lots of discouraging things as well. Crazy people that he had to deal with. Persons who tried to take Krishna's property, like Mr. N in Mumbai, famous story. And so many others who tried through legal means, through illegal means, to try to cause damage to Prabhupada or his mission because they felt it was a threat to their own name, fame and distinction, to the established agendas. Then there was so much disappointment from the inimical response of people who Prabhupada was preaching to. He was so disheartened once in France that he said, let's stop preaching here. After one occasion when he was, when he realized that there was just no receptivity at all in one meeting, he said, okay, let's stop. Our business is not to keep preaching, and forcing something into people's heads when they have no interest. The world is full of billions of people. So many have interest in making a success of their lives. Now, of course, all these things are in ups and downs. Countries go in ups and downs. Receptivity of people and populations goes in ups and downs. In different places and at different times. So there's no particular significance to the fact that it was France at that particular moment. So many countries have been unwelcoming to God, isn't it, around the world? There are some countries where God is almost a swear word. If you mention God, it's considered that you've actually committed a great offense to the ruler of the state, because you've undermined their position by considering someone else God. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Ki. And there are other places where God is definitely prioritized as the first and foremost. And these things all change over time. Nothing is permanent in this world. These phases come and go. One country can be highly saintly at a certain point, be highly demoniac 100 years later. There's no significance to it. It is simply the enactment of the modes of nature and the types of faith that people want. Faith is of different types according to the Gita, different modes. And according to that, one adopts a particular religion, lifestyle, way of life, philosophy, ideology, whatever it is. And those change according to the latest propaganda in force. So that's the story of this material world. The story of the spiritual world is that there is only one propaganda, and that's the propaganda of Krishna. What Krishna wants. Now, what Krishna wants is also far more exciting and variegated than what the kamis want. Their options are rather limited, actually. When a kami acts in this world, the only thing they have available to them is the objects of the senses from within this material world. That's it. There's nothing else. Satisfaction of the objects of the senses and some entertainment for the mind, intelligence, and ego. That's it. That's how they're limited. And the options for that are also limited, this material world. For an embodied person, those options are enough to keep us here for, I won't say generations, but for millions and millions and millions of cycles of going through different bodies and different species. It's enough to keep us here forever, practically. But in the big scheme of things, it's absolutely nothing and insignificant compared to the options available with Krishna. The range of options, even the range of sensory opportunities to please Krishna's senses, vastly outweighs the opportunities to please our senses here in this world. It's just of a different league. And so the chance to please Krishna is a rare chance. It's a rare privilege, and it's a rare situation that one has to serve and to please Krishna. Of course, so we would like that people actually serve Krishna. Why? Because it's actually better for them. It's actually better for them, and it's better for everyone around them. All rulers are typically happy when their citizens are submissive and happy and cooperative. And that is all possible with Krishna in the center. It's not possible with other agendas in the center. So Krishna's plan is one of unlimited enjoyment. The plan of the kamis is of limited enjoyment with an anticipation of unlimited enjoyment. An expectation of something unlimited from a situation which can only supply you something limited. That's not a sensible proposition. Us as spiritual sparks trapped in this body of dull matter is not a sensible proposition. There is no way this dull body, which has so many inconveniences, problems, adibhautik, adidevik, adiatmic miseries, birth, old age, disease and death, there is no way that that is a fitting vehicle for the spirit soul. But for persons like Kamsa, they consider it to be so. They consider that I have this powerful vehicle. In Kamsa's case, yes, powerful body, powerful mind, powerful intelligence, certainly a very powerful false ego. Definitely. They think, this is my vehicle, this is my identity, I must protect it at all costs. Now there's a threat to my life from some boys. Let me dispense with that threat. Is it likely to succeed? No, when the person who is the threat is the Supreme Lord himself, and the person completely outside of the realm of your dealings in matter, what is the chance that your material means will succeed? No chance. And so that is Kamsa's mentality. Now, Akrura's mentality is that somehow I'm in this unfortunate situation. I'm at danger of being persecuted and killed at any moment by Kamsa. Persons like Kamsa are highly volatile. It doesn't take much to flip them. He can promise you one thing and do something the next moment. Such is the way of diplomats. Such is the way of Kamsa's army and Kamsa's mentality. Anything can happen. So what should we do? So Akrura was thinking, let me simply invest my thinking, feeling and willing in Krishna. Krishna and Balaram. Every item that I see of theirs is a thought process correctly used. Every footprint that I meditate on is my brain cells firing correctly in a useful manner. They could be firing in a manner that allows me to think of Kamsa and the problems he will cause. But instead, let me absorb my entire consciousness in Krishna. Let me meditate upon his lotus feet. Let me meditate upon the beautiful symbols on his lotus feet. Let me meditate upon his beautiful yellow dhoti. Let me meditate upon the beautiful garland he wears, his beautiful shark-shaped earrings, his beautiful curly hair. Let me meditate upon Balaram, who is direct contrast with Krishna, shining, white, beautifully adorned, very powerful, wearing bluish garments. Let me meditate on that Lord Balaram. Because actually, if I just meditate on these two personalities, then that meditation can occupy my entire consciousness. And that consciousness is success. That is success. Better not to meditate on anything else. Better let me just accept the situation, just deal with it, and keep my entire faculties on the Supreme Lord. We don't really have anything to offer the Supreme Lord directly, because everything that we have has been given to us by the Supreme Lord anyway. Isn't it? All items, anything that we're thinking we want to offer to Krishna, maybe money, maybe facility, maybe expert conduct, all of that's been given by the Lord. But there is something which the Lord didn't really give us, which we have. And that is our desire to be the Lord and Master. That desire, we have to own it. That is something that we take responsibility for. I want to enjoy separate from you, Krishna. I want to be the center of attention. I want to enjoy the objects of the senses. That's something that is our responsibility. And together with that, that stems from the root of that, which is our desire, our capacity to think freely. Now that capacity itself is given by Krishna. Clearly, if Krishna wanted, he could subdue that capacity and actually subjugate anyone he wants. He's the Supreme Lord. Whereas demoniac persons in this world like to subjugate others, Krishna likes them to be free. Who would you rather be under? Which choice do you prefer? Even when you're in Goloka, even when you're in the Vaikuntha planets, Krishna does not take away your ability for you to choose whatever you want. And if you choose it, Krishna will make an arrangement for you to try it out. That's called the material world. How kind is he? Kind or unkind? It's debatable. But nevertheless, he's being reasonable. He's being very, very careful. Just as a father or a superior gives their subordinates, their sons, their daughters, some freedom to do something, Krishna gives his naughty children some freedom to do something. And it is that desire that is actually the only thing we have. That desire is the only thing that we can claim is ours. And that's literally the only thing we can offer to Krishna. Offer desire to please Krishna, to Krishna. Offer our consciousness of fulfilling that desire to Krishna. Come up with ways and means and plans to try to please Krishna. Our thinking, feeling, willing, our faculties, whatever we have, that's now given to us as subordinate principles based upon our desire. Our desire is ours, and then based upon us, based upon that, we have a subtle body, and based upon that, we have the gross body. So all of those things, those secondary items, the subtle body and the gross body, can all be used in the service of the Lord. And that is actually the transition. It is the transition from material consciousness to spiritual consciousness. It is the transition that we need to make as we approach Janmashtami. It is the transition of janma karma cha me divyam evam yo veti tatvatah tyaktva deham punarjanma naiti mam iti sorjana. It's the transition of trying to understand the transcendental nature of Krishna's divine appearance and activities. That understanding takes us forward. That understanding puts us into that realm where we are like Akrura. We're situated in that meditation. It's a very nice state to be in a state where, yes, we still have this body, but our thinking, feeling, willing, our minds, words, actions are actually all reposed in Krishna. That's a stage of Jivan Mukta. Iha yasya harer dasya karmana manasagira nikilashvapi avastasu jivan muktasu uchate. That when one serves the Supreme Lord with karmana manasagira, with one's mind, thinking, intelligence, words, and tries to serve the senses of the Lord, that's the special feature. When one serves the transcendental senses of the Lord with one's mind, intelligence, words, actions, thoughts, then one is considered a jivan mukta, liberated while in this world. Living as if a conditioned soul, but factually liberated. Because the object is no longer our senses, the object is the Lord's senses. So it's a very wonderful stage. It's a very wonderful situation. But it's one that is constantly challenged. Because as long as we are in this embodied state, in this material world, we are continuously tested by the material energy, by the agents of material energy within this world. And that's annoying. It's annoying, but maybe necessary. Maybe necessary for appreciating just how susceptible we are to moving away from Krishna. Every time a little impulse comes from the material energy, do this, satisfy this impulse, do this. How resistant are we? What percentage of those suggestions from the material world do we accept, and what percentage do we reject? That's a good statistic to work out for ourselves. Today I had 25 suggestions from the material energy. I had 4 suggestions from the spiritual world. What did I do? Was it spiritual world 4, material energy 0? Or was it material energy cleaned up the whole show? Which one was it? That's the challenge, actually. That is the challenge. That's the test that we can try as we head in towards Janmashtami. Of all the suggestions that keep us not in Jivan Mukta, but rather in a completely covered state, versus all the suggestions that are traits of Jivan Mukta. Thinking of what I can do for the Lord. Following the latest suggestion of the devotees to serve the Lord. Which of those is it? So this is Akrura's meditation. And I'll finish by just reading this beautiful description of Akrura's meditation on Krishna and Balaram. whom he actually now sees appearing before him in person. Now, once Akrura meets Krishna and Balaram, special pastime takes place as they journey back to Mathura. That's very beautifully described in this chapter of this 10th canto. Their wonderful interaction. And one of the things that Akrura is famous for is prayers. He's actually one of the examples of the person who offers prayers. Right? We know the different methods for devotional service. What are they? How do they begin? So, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Pada Sevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atma Nivedanam. And we also have different rasas, right? Different rasas within which one engages in an interaction with Krishna. What's interesting is that Dasya, which is today's subject, is actually one of the rasas and also a direct process of devotional service. Isn't it? Dasya ras is there. Dasyam is also one of the processes directly. Dasya actually pervades the entire spectrum of service to Krishna. Within the five rasas, and we are covering really only the four here because the Shanta rasa is typically not of much interest to devotees. The Shanta is an acceptance of understanding, connection with Krishna, his superior position. But it's a passive type of engagement. So devotees aren't particularly interested in that. But the other four rasas, Dasya, Vatsalya, Sakya, Madhurya, those are of great interest because there is the active principle of service. So this Dasya ras that Akrura is engaging in bringing Krishna back, this is a great service he's performing to Krishna. The gopis, of course, see it as a great disservice. But in Krishna's big scheme, still a service. This is a service Akrura is performing. And this service mood is actually a core component of all of these four rasas. So each of the higher rasas successively includes all of the functions of the earlier rasas. So what is the next highest rasa, higher rasa than Dasya ras? Sakya, right? Friendship, that is the next one. And so Sakya includes, in Krishna's world, elements of service, where friends serve each other. Often you hear about friends fighting and competing, but they also serve each other. They make friendships based upon that principle. Then on the higher rasa, Vatsalya rasa, that also includes service. How much service do the parents offer to the children? It's continuous service. And children are supposed to offer some service to the parents. Now, Vatsalya also includes friendships because dealings have to be friendly. Dealings are based upon my sakha, my child, my friend. Not on a level of equivalence, but still the notion of friendliness is there. And then finally, Madhurya ras, which includes all of these, where there is so much service that's offered. There's so much concern for Krishna. There's so much desire to please Krishna. And there's so much conjugal mellow there as well. So this Dasya ras is a very special core component of all the rasas. It is actually the prime rasa for our engagement as sadhakas. We don't prematurely pretend to be acting in any of the other rasas. But we're open to the idea that at some point Krishna will place us in any of these rasas according to his pleasure. Any of these mellows. Now as well as these five rasas, there are also the seven secondary rasas, which are the counterparts to those, making in total 12 rasas. So we focus really on these five. And Dasya is that unique linking factor which pervades all the rasas and is also somewhat inherently a part of each of the processes of devotional service. Because devotional service includes servitude. So Akrura is an example of one who offers vandanam. But that doesn't in any way diminish his position as a great dasya, as a great servant of the Lord, one engaged in Dasya Ras specifically. So this is Akrura's first darshan of Krishna and Balaram. And I'll just read it, and this can be maybe the meditation that we end with. How Akrura sees Krishna and Balaram appearing in his vision. Akrura then saw Krishna and Balaram in the village of Vraj, going to milk the cows. Krishna wore yellow garments, Balaram blue, and their eyes resembled autumnal lotuses. One of those two mighty armed youths, the shelter of the goddess of fortune, had a dark blue complexion. The others was white. With their fine-featured faces, they were the most beautiful of all persons. As they walked with the gait of young elephants, glancing about with compassionate smiles, those two exalted personalities beautified the cow pasture with the impressions of their feet, which bore the marks of the flag, lightning bolt, elephant goad, and lotus. These two lords, whose pastimes are most magnanimous and attractive, were ornamented with jeweled necklaces and flower garlands, anointed with auspicious fragrant substances, freshly bathed and dressed in spotless raiment. They were the primeval supreme personalities, the masters and original causes of the universes, who had for the welfare of the earth now descended in their distinct forms of Keshava and Balaram. O King Parikshit, they resembled two gold-bedecked mountains, one of emerald and the other of silver, as with their effulgence they dispelled the sky's darkness in all directions. Shri Shri Krishna Balaram ki, Shri Akrura ki. Any comments, questions? Prajan Prabhu?
One thing immediately came to into my mind as you describe that something beyond us, that there's something greater than us to go for than in this what we achieve in this world. And George Harrison was a classic example, and I remember in one of his interviews at the, near the end of his life, he was saying that when Prabhupada spoke to him, he gave him another dimension, one that he'd not considered, but considered to be beyond what we have here in this world. Because he had everything in this world by his experience,
yes,
theoretically. But when Prabhupada told him of something other than what was here, it touched him. He says it was something to go for. He said it's beyond. I found something that wasn't of this world that I needed, that was there beyond it, waiting for me. It gave him hope that there's something more than what he had understood from this world. And it was a very beautiful statement that he made there. He gave him that understanding that there is something that is beyond what we see and what we achieve in this world, which is took his intelligence away from this world. What this world told him he could get, but he knew he couldn't. There was nothing there.
Yes.
It gave him another dimension to go for, and. You know, so he was like a classic example, really, of somebody who'd achieved everything, so-called, in this world. But then he saw something
else
beyond it.
We need personalities like that. They actually inspire us. Because most people you can say will not be accomplished to the degree of George Harrison or others in whichever realm they're in. Name, fame, whatever it is, strength, power, beauty. Most people will not be at the highest levels of those. They'll be somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. What is highly inspiring is that when we see examples of individuals who are very accomplished, are very highly advanced, or very, or they've achieved something, but they've discovered something superior to that, That has a lot of weight. For example, when George Harrison, who has all the fame in the world, and at one point he was exceptionally famous, wealth, attention, all comes with it. This is what most people want. This is what most teenagers were dreaming of becoming, having all this fame, and this is why many join rock bands, start rock bands, or whatever it is, just so that they can experience some of that. But for him then to say that actually for all this propaganda, it hasn't delivered what it promised. It didn't deliver it. The substances didn't supply what they claimed to do. The attention didn't do what it was supposed to do. The money didn't do what it was supposed to do. So such persons are good examples for us. Look at the Goswamis. I mean, Rupa and Sanatan Goswami were, you know, they were not individuals who had nothing. They were individuals who were in top positions. They had anything, they had everything the material world could offer them within their situations. They were protected, they had armies at their disposal, they had money at their disposal, they had beautiful families, they constructed palaces to live in. And they realized that there is actually something superior to this. That hopefully should give the rest of us a little idea. If we have any tinges of trying to obtain these things, it is a different matter to have a minimum sufficient amount required for us to survive and to perform devotional service. That is a standard which is acceptable and everyone is entitled to. But the idea of trying to obtain lofty heights of wealth, opulence, power, fame, these pursuits in this world, it is the opinion of those who have achieved those that these pursuits are not worthwhile. If someone doesn't have something and they're making a large propaganda as to why you shouldn't have it also, that's not particularly powerful propaganda. That's the propaganda of envy. I don't have it, therefore you can't possibly have it. And even if you do have it, it probably wasn't worth having anyway. That's the mentality, right? If you're, what does it matter anyway? What does it matter that you've got this? It's obviously not that important because I don't have it. So that's the unfortunate situation of the material world and material consciousness. But really the reality is that most people are on that platform. We also have that tendency to degrade to that platform quite quickly, in all honesty, quite quickly. As soon as the notion of envy comes up or arises in the heart. So it's a problem. So it is always good to take examples like this from the real world. Prabhupada would always use examples like this. He would say, look at these people. He would say, look at all these American boys and girls who have joined. They're from wealthy families. They have so many things, but they have given it up to serve Krishna. And now they live like servants in the house of Krishna. And he would say this to people who would come to see him. And he would glorify them and promote them like this. They have now found something of substance. It's a good idea if you also consider it. It's important. So every single person, it is not that these material qualities define anything great for us. But if we are enamored by something, then it is always good to look at the people who have achieved the same things that we are aspiring for. Only if you are a really demoniac person like Hiranyakashipu do you want something that no one else has achieved. Or even Dhruva Maharaj wanted something that no one else has achieved. And later on, he thought, this is a really regrettable thought that I had. Mm-hmm. That I wanted a kingdom greater than Lord Brahma's. What a waste of time that was. What a waste of a thought. I should have asked for pure devotional service. So if we really want something in this material world, and it is not at the level of basic subsistence, basic needs, basic requirements, one should a choir, or one should conduct themselves with the minimum needed for bodily maintenance. Nothing else should be the goal of one's works, as the Bhagavatam says. That is a good way to conduct ourselves. Anyone else like to something? Cyrus Prabhu.
So Prabhu, very nice class as always. So you talk about desires, you know, earlier, and so Prabhupada made the point with George Harrison's example there, and so those examples are there, and Prabhupada, through his he was such a perfect practitioner. Mm. He would bring those examples out.
Mm.
But I was thinking, as you see, because you mentioned desire, I'm thinking, well, desires are so strong in human beings. So if we desire material things, then Krishna is like material energy is obliged to supply. So those desires become very, very strong. And then we can't see the examples around us so much. Because the desires cover us, you know. Are great examples, and what we desire is nonsense. But still, desire is so strong that we can't see.
Because it covers us.
Yeah.
Exactly the point. Bhogaishvarya prasaktanam tahi paritish chetesam vyapasayatmika buddhi samadho na vidyate samadhi na vidyate does not manifest. When you're covered by these desires, it's a fact. In fact, that's why we have to free up some capacity in our minds in order to focus on Krishna. Harmless though it may seem, that's the reality. Harmless it may be, but it's still occupying our intelligence, our abilities. Yes, that's the danger. Any other? Yes, Prabhuji.
Thank you for the class, Prabhu. So I had a question about the 9 persons of devotional service. We are in ISKCON, we must go from the Dasya Ras, always, you know, that's just, we don't try and imitate any other Ras or try and go for any other Ras. We should know that Krishna is going to provide that for us when he feels like we're ready for something. But in the 9 persons of devotional service, number 8 is considering and treating the Lord as one's best friend.
Sakyam.
And you gave example when you were talking about the pilgrimages and Sakshi Gopal.
Yes.
You were saying
yes,
that
last
to
week.
Yeah. You were saying that to serve the lotus feet of the Lord, you can take you can do pilgrimage in that way. My question is that. What is a practical way we can serve and treat the Lord as a best friend in the 9 persons of devotional service?
Yes. The Lord, well, first of all, you understand it from a point of tattva, that the Lord is our best friend. Suridam sarvadehinam. Surit, he's very, very close to us. Bhoktaram yagyatapasam sarvaloka maheshwaram suridam sarva bhutanam gyatva mam shantim richati. He is the one who is right there in the core of the heart. There's actually no one else who is closer to us. We might think, my nearest and dearest. But actually it's not possible because he's right there, right next to us. So from a factual point of view, he is there in the core of the heart as Paramatma. And so he is our best friend. He's the person we turn to. Typically as a friend, when we consider our friends, we turn to them. We turn to them in our times of happiness. We share our happiness with our friends. And we turn to them in times of sadness also. We share our sadness, our concerns with others. So that it becomes the problem is not just yours. It's everyone's. The happiness is shared. And the problems are also shared in that sense. So that's how we can adopt a mood of friendship. First of all, we practice it with devotees. But with the Lord also, he's ultimately the person that we share all our happiness and distress with. When something nice happens to us, we should thank the Lord. My dear Lord, look, this wonderful thing happened. Thank you so much. My dear Lord, today I experienced a little setback. We might not want to thank the Lord at that point, But later on, we might do so, like Queen Kunti. Vipada sanduta shashvat tatra tatra jagadguru bhavato darshanam yat syat apunar bhava darshanam. These calamities come again and again, so I can see you again and again. At the time, you don't think that always. But at least if we've heard this and we're trying to remember it in our minds, we might still think like that. We might still say to the Lord, "Dear Lord, today this thing happened to me. Thank you. Thank you, even though I don't like it. Still, I understand that your plan is there somewhere. Thank you." takes maturity, and it might not be easy. I'll be the first to admit it. But still, at least theoretically, we can. Right now, we can think that I would like to do that in the future. And so that's kind of like a constant mood of friendship that we need to have with the Lord. We don't necessarily think that the Lord reciprocates with us as a friend, necessarily, in that sense. Because that's a little tricky, because, you know, you have to be like Sudama or Subal or someone like that to be actually thinking that the Lord is my friend and, you know, he will carry me on my back. You know, that's on his back, sorry, he will carry me on his back. That's their sort of entitlement. So we have to just draw a line at a certain point. That the Lord is our friend, we share our hearts with Him, we share our interactions with Him, so we're friendly to the Lord, but we don't necessarily assume that He has accepted us as a friend, directly. So we just have to be careful of that, but otherwise it's, with those two things, we can make a good attempt at it, from a point of tattva and then from a point of just sharing everything we have with the Lord. Anyone else? Yes, David, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you for the class. I was trying to understand in terms of the rasas and santaras. Why should we worry about our rasas in terms of we might have a sarup, which might be a santaras.
Why should we worry about it?
Yes, in terms of we aspire, that we shouldn't actually worry about what rasa we have, rather than just service or devotional service.
Yes. When worrying about the rasa is not a useful use of our thinking capacity. Ultimately, we should be satisfied that Krishna will put us in whichever situation he's happy with. We also hear, of course, you know, in Nectar of Devotion, different places, that the whole development given as to how one's rasa, one's actual inherent sthayi bhava is awakened. That can, and it's also described that one has a sort of an inherent tendency to be in one of the rasas, an inherent sort of position, which is due to our unique, us as unique living entities, unique individual entities, that we have that connection with Krishna. But we don't need to worry about it, definitely.
Yes, but in terms of understanding that, you know, we don't naturally aspire for santaras, but in the spiritual world we might have a svarup, which we
right, might... Yes, so this is another important point, that the rasa that we occupy in the spiritual world is not in the sadhaka stage the rasa that describes our activities here. In the Nectar of Devotion, there's process described where through an association with an advanced sadhaka in a particular rasa, your rasa is developed and awakened. That is a process whereby it happens. And that is more in higher stages. That is more in sort of where elements of Raganuga, Bhava Bhakti, Prema Bhakti start to manifest more. In a practitioner stage, and this is why the stages are important, in a practitioner stage, in a sadhaka stage, our mode is service. Even through that service, we may acquire a position as a Shantaras devotee in the spiritual world. That is possible. So there's not really a direct connection. We may awaken our natural rasa, as things go on, But we shouldn't be overly concerned about it. It's an example sort of set by Mahaprabhu. That our focus is not necessarily on trying to equate or harmonize our actions at the moment with the rasa we occupy in the spiritual world. Our focus really should be on sadhaka. Bhakti Chura Maharaj gave a very nice explanation once about Raganuga Bhakti. And he mentioned that, you know, sometimes people say that in ISKCON you have no understanding of Raganuga Bhakti. Because you're always just focused on Vaidhi Sadhana. That's all you know. Just Vaidhi Bhakti, Vaidhi Sadhana. Well, he said, the reason our focus is on Vaidhi Sadhana is because that is the example set by the Goswamis who are direct disciples or followers of Lord Chaitanya and who are instructed to manifest this lifestyle for future followers. Now, when you please the instructions given to us by the Goswamis and Lord Chaitanya, you are pleasing Lord Chaitanya by following the service recommended by him. And Lord Chaitanya is the ultimate ragatmika bhakta. Lord Chaitanya is not he's not someone at the neophyte stages, at the really early stages of understanding his connection with Krishna. Lord Chaitanya is the ultimate ragatmika bhakta, who has not just Raganuga Bhakti, but Bhava Bhakti, Prema Bhakti, and all the stages, right to the topmost. Because he has the mood of Radharani himself. So by executing Vaidhi Sadhana in pursuit of the Goswamis of Vrindavan, we attain a result, which is any result that Lord Chaitanya wants to give us. So there's no conflict there. We are following very clearly a path which gives us access to the highest rasa that the Lord wants us to be in. And development of rasa is, of course, what Nectar of Devotion describes as something essential for us. We are filled with mundane rasa, which is tasteless. The only way for us to succeed is to have some idea of spiritual rasa. Well, we need to develop it. Does that sort of...
Yes, thank you, Ru. Just a question is, if one is Santa Rasa in the spiritual world, can they be Krishna's father or mother in this world?
Well, just be careful, because the moment you are Krishna's anything in this world, you are no longer in this world.
Yes.
So if you have a chance to be Krishna's father or mother in this world, it's nothing to do with the material world anymore. You've already been situated in that rasa. So then it's highly likely that your position is as a father and mother of Krishna. Because if we look at the different examples, Sutapa and Prishni, Lord Chaitanya is his father and mother, Sachi Mata, he says, you have been my father and mother generation after generation. Yeah, Devaki, Vasudev, same thing. You've been my father and mother generation after generation, life after life. Whenever I appear, you are my father and mother. So the position's taken in one sense. Vacancy's gone.
In terms of like the gopis, they were sages who desired a certain rasa, so they became that conjugal love as they desired it.
Yes. Yes, they were the gopis. The participants in Krishna's lila were of two characters, two types. Some were actually sent by Krishna, and they were members of the demigods, and they were sent to assist Krishna with his pastimes. Then there were others who are at a stage of progress in their spiritual lives, and the natural next stage of their fructification is that they get to enjoy with Krishna, but they also undergo severe austerities in the past. But there are others also who are not in any of these categories, but they are the direct personal internal Ladini Shakti, or the internal potency of Krishna, who he manifests as his gopis. So yes, there are gopis of different categories.
Thank you, Ru.
So it doesn't exclude. That yes, it's true that yes, some achieved that by performing great activities as sages in the past. But others were there without having done that. But really, the members of the internal potency voluntarily perform austerities typically far greater than any sadhaka ever does. They voluntarily do austerities, even though they don't have to, because they're already part of Krishna's internal energy. It is the, as Krishna says, you know, I am situated in acts of sacrifice and penance. He says that. Brahmanas are continuously situated, and I am the heart of the Brahmanas. So it is a natural trait that Krishna's own manifestations and expansions exhibit a tendency towards great penance when they come to this world. They do that. Even Krishna's leelas, they rotate around sometimes doing penance for different purposes. Krishna does many duties in Dwarka. He observes meditation. He observes fasts. He does different things. Radharani practices walking on thorny paths. Why does she do that? Walks on sharp thorns, paths, pebbles. She doesn't have to. But she does it so that when she has to go and meet Krishna, if she steps on a thorn and she screams, it might draw attention from others. So she practices. She practices that. So that when she has the chance to go to see Krishna, she doesn't disrupt the whole situation, the whole affair of giving pleasure to Krishna by spoiling it by some tendency or some just inadvertent mistake. So she tries to guard against all things. And she's Radharani studies. One of her names is Vidyarthini, one who perpetually studies, a perpetual student. What does she have to study? She's the superintendent of bhakti, and our bhakti comes from her. But she's constantly doing that. So she engages in austerity, she constantly studies, she constantly does so many things. And all the devotees of Krishna do that. Whatever situation they're in. So it's an interesting world, Krishna's. He has his personal associates, he has others who have progressed there through different practices. He has others who he sends there for specific purposes, who then don't come back to him directly, but they go back to their original purposes, like the demigods. It's very interesting. He has his entourage has many categories of people in it. So Krishna's appearance is for this purpose. In the Bhagavatam, it is mentioned that when Krishna appears in the world, he displays pastimes. Why does he display pastimes? He displays pastimes to reclaim the fallen conditioned souls. That's one thing he does. Yes, he's engaged in his pastimes anyway. But one of the side effects that happens when he comes to this world is that it offers the fallen conditioned souls a chance to be reclaimed so that they're attracted by seeing those pastimes. They're attracted, their hearts are drawn to him, and they have a chance to be saved. So that's Krishna's kindness. That's Janmashtami. That's devotional service. Shri Krishna Janmashtami ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Hare Krishna.